Key economic releases affecting fixed income yields. Insights into sectors influencing fixed income securities. How AAM plans to capitalize on these themes for your fixed income portfolio. The Portfolio Fix is a podcast series featuring members of AAM's investment and portfolio management team. We will discuss the timely issues affecting the fixed income investments of our insurance clients.
Welcome to episode one of the Portfolio Fix, a podcast series from AAM. My name is Patrick McGeever, and I'm a member of the investment team. I am joined today by Marco Bravo, who has been managing portfolios for AAM clients for almost 25 years. He also leads our economic committee. Welcome, Marco.
Thanks, Pat.
So today you hosted AAM's monthly economic meeting. We discussed many things such as railcar loadings, advertising spending, retail spending, housing, and oil demand. And the group lowered our economic growth forecast for the second half of 2019 to just below 2%. Maybe you can discuss what were the key items that led us to lower our growth forecast for the second half of the year?
Sure. And to put things in perspective, the economy grew at roughly a 2.6% pace for the first half of 2019, and the expectation is for that growth rate to slow to around a 1.8 to 1.9% GDP growth rate. So definitely expecting a slower growth pace in the second half relative to the first half. And that's really being driven by reduction in business investment and manufacturing activity. We've seen sentiment indicators among manufacturers decline during the month of August. Fixed business investment from durable good orders reports were weaker than expected. So we're definitely seeing a slowdown on the manufacturing sector. On the consumer side, which consumers represent a little bit over 70% of economic growth here in the U.S., you know, things are still fairly positive, and retail sales started the quarter off very strong. We're going to get a new number later this week. But we feel consumer spending continues to be supported by a healthy labor market, low unemployment, and rising wages.
What are some of the risks that could lead to either better growth than we're expecting or weaker growth than we're expecting?
Sure. Well, the two that, you know, are on most economists' mind today on the downside are trade uncertainties and slowing global growth. And we believe they've already began to impact sentiment here in the U.S. among manufacturers, reducing their production, reducing their plans for investment. So those are two big risks we see, downside risks that we see for economic growth moving forward. On the positive front, some of the factors I mentioned earlier that are affecting the consumer: wage growth continues to be strong, unemployment rate low. We're not seeing any signs that companies are laying off people or an increase in layoffs or reducing the hours worked for their workers, which is a very positive sign that consumer spending should continue at a fairly healthy clip.
Okay. Actually, you mentioned something today I learned in our meeting. You mentioned the difference between the Michigan consumer sentiment and the Conference Board consumer survey. Can you explain that, what the difference is, or why they might be diverging right now?
Sure. And it's worth noting that consumer confidence is followed. We follow it very closely to get some indicator of the feeling among consumers and will they continue to spend at current levels, or if they're feeling more optimistic, maybe we may see an increase in spending. And those two indices, the Conference Board Consumer Index and University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index, tracks the confidence among consumers. And they've diverged here recently, with the Conference Board Index showing some positive momentum, while the University of Michigan in the month of August, showing a very steep decline in confidence. And really the big difference is the conference board, the questions that they ask is really more focused on the labor market. And given my comments earlier that the labor market remains fairly healthy, it's not surprising that we haven't seen a decline in consumer confidence as indicated by the conference board. Whereas the University of Michigan index is more focused on financial conditions. And given the volatility that we saw in the month of August with the stock market, again, it's not surprising that that is feeding into sentiment among consumers, and we saw the decline that we saw during that month.
Great. That's something I was not aware of until today. So what does this mean for the 10-year then? Do we expect much change from the current level of 1.6%, given that there's somewhat of a cloudy economic picture?
We don't. Rates remain very low. They're off their most recent lows, with the 30-year now back above 2% and the 10-year hovering around 1.6%. But the expectation is for rates to move just modestly higher from current levels, and the demand from foreign investors, given the relative attractiveness of U.S. assets, U.S. bonds relative to other countries, is creating demand for our assets, and capital is flowing into the U.S., which should keep U.S. rates here lower and also support the U.S. dollar.
Yeah, okay. And so with AAM forecasting sub 2% growth in the second half of the year, and then a sub 2% 10-year bond, is it fair to say that we are pessimistic about a U.S.-China trade agreement in the near term?
Yes, I think it's very fair to say that. We are not optimistic that we will get a resolution to the U.S.-China trade disputes before year end.
Okay. So if we saw some type of progress on a trade agreement in the near term, that could change the yield on 10 years, on the 10-year bond, pretty dramatically. Is that fair?
We think it could, but again, there's the issue of the negative yields around the world, the ECB cutting rates to try to spur economic growth in Europe, as well as the Bank of Japan. So even with a resolution to the trade disputes, it's unclear if that's really going to push world rates higher to make the relative attractiveness among U.S. and world rates less so.
Okay. All right, so before we wrap up this segment of the podcast, can you maybe highlight to the audience what economic release or statement you think will be most important in the upcoming week?
There's a few data numbers that are coming out. Tomorrow we'll get optimism among small businesses. That's a very closely watched indicator to get a feel for how small businesses are feeling. And you would think that the small businesses really aren't being impacted as much with trade disputes. And so far, we have not seen sentiment among small businesses decline. We'll see that tomorrow. Consumer price inflation, obviously important as we think about what the Fed's going to do going forward. So far, it's been very limited pressure on inflation. We believe that's going to continue. We'll get the August retail sales number. So I mentioned earlier, retail sales in July was strong. We started off Q3 in a strong note. We'll see if that continued into August or if the volatility in the markets caused consumers to pull back a little bit. And then the University of Michigan consumer sentiment at the end of the week. We'll see if that continues to decline or if it begins to stabilize as markets here have improved over the last couple of weeks.
Okay. Thanks for that, Marco. We'll definitely stay focused on the small business survey, the inflation report, retail sales, and the University of Michigan sentiment report. And we look forward to your analysis of those results on our next podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, I am joined by Garrett Dungy, our healthcare analyst. Garrett has been involved in fixed income investments for over 9 years and has been instrumental in advancing our understanding of the ever-changing healthcare world since he joined AAM several years ago. So welcome, Garrett.
Thanks, Pat.
You recently led a company-wide meeting to discuss the latest developments surrounding healthcare policy. It's such a broad and complex topic with sensitive issues like Medicare for All, drug pricing, and opioid litigation. And I think you stated that it was a number one issue for voters heading into the 2020 election. So I guess to start off, maybe you could let us know which ways the government is getting involved to help improve healthcare affordability for the public.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Pat. This is the top issue for voters. It's been the top issue election after election. And what we're seeing now that 2020 elections are on the horizon is that the Congress and the White House are kind of ramping up efforts to introduce bills, legislation, policies just to help do that and really attack the rising healthcare costs that's becoming quite a problem for many people in this country. But it remains one of the most divisive issues in politics, and the question remains, what's the right level of government involvement and whether or not healthcare is a right?
So something that's been debated quite a bit over the past several months has been single payer or Medicare for all. What updates can you provide for us?
Yeah, in regards to updates, I think Medicare for All, you know, it sounds great. And what we've been seeing in the past few months is a lot of the Democratic candidates either backing away from that proposal. That proposal would basically guarantee healthcare as a right for all U.S. citizens. And when we think about the amount of people that are either underinsured or uninsured, it adds a lot to think about there in terms of, you know, what that would actually do in terms of increasing demand for healthcare services and thinking about how the government's role would grow. Would they be able to generate cost savings, eliminate waste, and exactly how they would go about financing it? So I think there's a lot to be explained that we haven't seen yet. There's a lot of inputs, a lot of rhetoric around it. And I think when you think about the DNC and what they have to do to produce a candidate for the general election, what route do they want to go? Do they want to go this more progressive Medicare for All, or kind of stay more moderate and go towards universal health care, or kind of expanding the ACA as it is right now? And if they went the Medicare for All route, it would be extremely disruptive to our current healthcare system, and it's not going to be an easy thing to explain to voters. As I mentioned earlier, we've seen some Democratic candidates kind of move away in recent months and kind of put towards more moderate, still left-leaning proposals for an expansion for Medicare, which would reduce the eligible age to go into Medicare.
Okay. Are there any regulatory measures out there that look more promising than Medicare for All?
Yeah, I think where we are seeing traction is in terms of lower drug pricing. We're seeing bipartisan support from both sides of the aisle in Congress, and we're also seeing the current administration support initiatives for lower drug pricing. You know, there seems to be a number of bills that have been introduced, but again, healthcare being such a divisive issue, we've seen these bills kind of go through committees, and there's just slight disagreements on how to bring those bills forward to vote on. So right now we have three committees in the Senate working on drug pricing proposals. We have the Democrats in the House working on their own proposals, and in addition to Speaker Pelosi negotiating with the president on drug pricing. And we also have the White House that's introducing its own proposals for lower drug price initiatives.
Okay, and so from your discussion, it sounds like there is bipartisan support for lower drug prices and lower healthcare costs. But why haven't we seen much traction on either front?
Yeah, you know, I think it's the complexity of the healthcare supply chain, healthcare system in general. Looking at the congressional hearings earlier this year, a lot of blame being put on all the parties involved, but there wasn't one person to point the finger at. So, you know, there's a lot to figure out there. And I think you also have the strong lobbying powers of the players involved, that being the drug manufacturers, the PBM insurers, and also the distributors that, do have Congress's ear on how they would like to shape legislation. So what we'll see here, I think, coming up, Congress is returning from their summer recess, and they kind of face a short timeline here to get bills approved before the 2020 elections become the focus next year. So I think we could actually see a little bit of progress and traction on that forefront this year.
The last question, Garrett, is what sectors or industries could see added risk or volatility if you are wrong in your assessment of government involvement?
Yeah, so I guess our assessment right now is that there is a low probability of Medicare for All. If we were wrong in that assessment and there were public options for Medicare or more government involvement in the drug supply chain, you know, we would think that the first biggest negative sector we would look at would be PBMs. We think they would take a fairly large hit there in addition to the distributor space. And with Medicare expanding, we would expect to see hits to Medicaid and the health exchange managed care companies. While we think the larger MCOs would be able to kind of mitigate that risk through their Medicare Advantage businesses growing. We'd also expect definitely pressures in the not-for-profit hospital space as the percentage of Medicare payers increase due to the lower reimbursement rates that they have.
Okay, can I interrupt?
Yeah.
So you don't think these are high probability events though, correct?
I do not.
Okay.
And I guess the last sector I'll touch on is just managed care. There is definitely a possibility that private insurance is eliminated. Given how low the risk, I think there should be some compensation there for that risk. And I think we're starting to see that in the market with spreads widening in that sector. But I think bottom line is this sector, the issues in hand are going to remain very important to voters this election cycle, the next. And as a result, healthcare is just going to remain in that regulatory hot seat for some time. While many of these events, these high severity events are low probability, they're going to generate headlines, and that's going to cause uncertainty among investors and potentially the sector to underperform its peers. So while we're not avoiding the sector entirely, we are taking a thoughtful approach to how we allocate funds to IG Healthcare, and we are accounting for all of these regulatory factors in our credit selection process.
Great. Yeah, I'm sure this is going to be a sector where there's a tremendous amount of volatility, and there will be significant developments as we approach November 2020 with the election. So I hope you can join us again in the not too distant future with those updates. So thanks to you, Garrett, and thanks to you for listening to the Portfolio Fix. If you have questions about anything we discussed today, please reach out to your portfolio manager or contact our marketing team at aamcompany.com. That's A as in asset, A as in allocation, M as in management, company.com. During our next podcast, Marco will provide a preview of the Fed's September 18th meeting, and Elizabeth Henderson will provide an update on the telecom and technology sectors. Thank you.